Okay, so strap yourselves in, folks. Today we're taking a deep dive into some seriously heavy stuff. We're going to be looking at Syria, but not just the conflict on its surface.
Right.
We've got this article here that makes a really, I mean, really thought-provoking argument. It's saying that Syria being a physical wasteland, you know, all the destruction there, it's like a mirror, right?
Yeah.
It reflects back on the West and this potential for us to create our own wasteland, metaphorically speaking, of course.
Of course, yeah.
But not just, you know, in a physical sense.
Right.
They're talking about morality,
right.
Economics, the whole political landscape, even going as far as, like, the spiritual side of things.
It's a powerful analogy. Using that very real, very brutal destruction in Syria to highlight some uncomfortable parallels, some potentially self-destructive patterns that might be playing out within the West itself.
Exactly. And before we go any further, I just want to say, straight up, this isn't about fear-mongering. You know, we're not trying to, like, freak anyone out.
Yeah.
It's more about using Syria as this, like, case study to examine some stuff that might be a little closer to home for our listeners.
Closer to home, maybe.
Even within ourselves. So let's jump right in, shall we?
Let's do it.
The article, it paints this stark picture, like really stark. They call it a deliberately engineered wasteland in Syria.
To understand what they mean by that, I think you have to really grasp the sheer scale of the destruction.
Uh-huh.
This is, we're talking 70% of healthcare facilities completely destroyed.
Got it.
The clinics that are somehow still standing. 90% supply shortages.
Wow.
Barely 45% of water treatment plants are actually operational, which, no surprise, leads to cholera outbreaks.
It's a full-blown humanitarian crisis.
And then there's the electricity, only 12% of pre-war capacity. And key highways, the M4 and M5, they've been cut off, severed.
Wow.
That blocks essential trade, transportation routes. It's just devastating.
So you've got the war itself, obviously causing a lot of this damage. But the article goes further.
Yeah, a lot further. They're not letting the West off the hook.
Right.
They argue that Western sanctions, often presented as this humanitarian response, right?
Yeah.
Well, they say these sanctions are actually making the suffering much worse and blocking any real chance of Syria recovering.
It's strong stuff, calling them a form of economic warfare.
It is. And they say it's directly harming civilians.
Directly.
They cite a Reuters report showing that even the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, is facing huge delays trying to restore Syria's electricity.
Why is that?
Because of the sanctions. The sanctions are blocking the parts they need.
The parts?
The necessary spare parts to fix the grid.
Really?
Then they bring in Wikipedia.
Okay.
Pointing out that even medical equipment, things for hospitals and components needed to fix basic infrastructure like those water plants, they're severely restricted. Almost impossible to repair anything. It makes you think twice about these sanctions.
Yeah, it really does. It's not just about targeting bad guys. It's affecting regular people trapped to survive.
That's their point. It's challenging that narrative we often hear, right?
Right.
That sanctions are this precise tool only hurting the powerful. The reality seems much different.
It's bleak. But here's where this deep dive takes that turn. It gets even more fascinating.
Okay.
The article uses all this, Syria's situation, as this mirror to look at the West's own potential for creating wastelands.
Metaphorically speaking.
Right. Not in the physical sense, like blown up buildings, but in other ways. They look at it through four lenses: moral, economic, political, and then spiritual.
It's like they're holding up this distorted mirror. The reflection, it's familiar, but it's also like deeply unsettling, you know.
It is.
And they start with this idea of a moral wasteland.
Okay, so morally speaking, they argue that Western nations, you know, we talk this big game about humanitarian aid, intervention, helping out, right?
We do.
But then in reality, it's often used to push our own political agendas.
Mm-hmm. They introduce this idea of selective compassion, saying the West's response to global crises, it's not always driven by genuine humanitarian concern.
Selective compassion. So basically, we care more about some crises than others. Like, it depends which one's on TV the most.
That's part of it, yeah. Media plays a role. They argue that cultural proximity matters, too, how close we feel to the people affected. And then, of course, there are strategic interests, you know.
The stuff we can gain from getting involved.
It's a cynical view.
But they're saying, in the case of Syria, aid and intervention, it hasn't always been about just helping people, but about achieving specific goals.
Geopolitical goals, exactly.
It really makes you think, doesn't it?
Like,
how much of what we see is driven by genuine empathy versus you know, other stuff.
It challenges our assumptions, that's for sure.
Okay, so that's the moral wasteland. What about the economic one? They draw some pretty stark parallels there between what's happening in Syria, the economic collapse, and some of the problems we see in the West, like stagnant wages, that growing gap between rich and poor, all the debt we've racked up.
They depict Western economies as these, like, houses of cards built on a mountain of debt.
And bubbles, right?
Yeah.
Like financial bubbles waiting to burst.
Yeah. They even go so far as to say that the 2008 financial crisis, that was basically a warning shot.
A tremor before the big one.
Exactly. And they tie this back to Syria, saying both situations are rooted in this idea of economic starvation, where resources get sucked up to the top and everyone else is left scrambling.
So even though the mechanisms are different, war and sanctions in Syria versus financial policies and deregulation here.
Right.
The end result is kind of the same, that concentration of wealth and power at the top, creating instability for everyone else.
Yeah, that's their argument. And that brings us to the third wasteland. They identify the political one.
Okay, so this is where they get into how Western democracy, maybe it's becoming more of a facade, right?
A facade. They call it a plutocracy, where the wealthy elite have the real power, no matter who we vote for.
And they point to things like gerrymandering and voter suppression, especially in places like North Carolina.
Like they're rigging the system.
Yeah. What's interesting is how they link this, the erosion of democracy in the West, to what's happening in Syria.
That fragmentation, the instability.
They're saying both are driven by this loss of trust. Like people don't believe in the system anymore, that it works for them. And then they bring up places like Hungary and Poland, where it seems like things are shifting more towards authoritarianism.
They use those examples to show it's not just an American thing. It's a global trend.
And that's pretty scary if you think about it. Like if democracy is failing all over the world, what happens then?
That's a big question.
Yeah. We might need a whole other deep dive to unpack that one. But first, let's get into that final wasteland. They talk about the spiritual and intellectual one.
Okay.
This is where things get, well, I'd say they get pretty bleak. They paint a picture of Western culture as this void.
Nihilistic.
Materialistic. Like we've lost our sense of meaning, our connection to anything bigger than ourselves.
They talk about truth being buried under mountains of information, disinformation, propaganda, spin. It's hard to even tell what's real anymore. It leads to this feeling of disillusionment, cynicism, like what's the point?
Yeah, and they bring in some heavy hitters to make their point. They quote T.S. Eliot, that line about April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land.
It's powerful, right?
Yeah. Like they're saying our culture is that dead land.
They also mentioned Christopher Lash. He talked about the moral wasteland back in the day. And of course, there's Orwell.
In a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
Right.
Like they're saying we're living in that time of deceit.
They see a direct connection between this perceived decline, spiritually, intellectually, and the West's role in the Syrian conflict.
That's where they use that phrase, willful blindness, right? Like, we're choosing not to see the consequences of our actions, whether it's military intervention or sanctions.
It's a powerful image, that willful blindness, turning away from the suffering, the destruction that we might have played a part in creating.
It's a lot to take in, but it really makes you think. How do we even begin to navigate a world where truth is so slippery?
And where do we find meaning and purpose when it feels like everything's falling apart?
Right, when the systems we've relied on, the narratives we've believed in, they just don't seem to hold up anymore.
It's not just about Syria. It's about how we understand ourselves, our place in the world, and the choices we make in the face of these massive challenges.
And that's something we all need to grapple with. Maybe the problems in Syria aren't just over there. Maybe they're a reflection of something broken, something out of whack within our own systems, our own ways of thinking.
It's a tough pill to swallow, but...
But it's a conversation we need to have. So we've got Syria as a reflection of these potential wastelands in the West, right? Mm-hmm. Morally, economically, politically, spiritually.
Like the big areas.
Four huge areas. But why? What's at the root of all this? Why is this happening?
Well, the article doesn't mince words here. They point to four main culprits. Hubris, historical amnesia, power, and greed.
Whoa, okay, that's a heavy list. Let's break those down. What do they mean by hubris? I hear that word all the time, but...
In this context, they're talking about that deep-seated belief in Western exceptionalism, this idea that the West is somehow above the laws of history, immune to the forces that have brought down other empires.
So basically, arrogance. A blindness to our own flaws.
Exactly. And they argue that this hubris prevents us from learning from the mistakes of the past, which as we know, makes us much more likely to repeat them.
And that's where the historical amnesia comes in. It's like we've collectively forgotten the lessons of history, particularly when it comes to things like imperialism and the dangers of intervention.
They use several historical examples to illustrate this point. They talk about the Sykes-Picot Agreement after World War I. That's where the Western powers basically carved up the Ottoman Empire.
Without really considering the people who actually lived there, their cultures, their religions.
Exactly. They ignored the ethnic and sectarian realities on the ground, which, as they argue, created the conditions for decades of conflict.
Including the mess we see in Syria today. It's like the decisions made back then, they're still having consequences a century later.
Long-lasting consequences. And then they jump ahead to the Suez Crisis in 1956.
That was a pretty big deal.
They frame it as this humiliating defeat for the old imperial powers, Britain and France.
Orchestrated in part by a rising United States.
Right. The U.S. was flexing its hustles on the world stage. They argue that this crisis exposed the limits of Western power.
And helped accelerate the process of decolonization.
But
they're saying the West didn't really learn the lesson.
About the dangers of imperial overreach. Which brings us to a much more recent example, the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, that was a controversial one, to say the least.
They don't hold back, calling it a catastrophic blunder based on manipulated intelligence and delusional fantasies about nation building.
It's a strong statement, but it's hard to argue with the results.
They argued that the Iraq war wasn't just a mistake. It was a symptom of this deeper pattern.
This hubris, this historical amnesia. They're saying it's still playing out today, that we're still making the same mistakes, clinging to this idea that we know what's best for everyone else.
That we have the right to intervene, to impose our will on the world. And that brings us to the final two culprits on their list, power and greed.
Okay, let's unpack that a bit. How do they see power and greed contributing to all of this?
They argue that the relentless pursuit of power and wealth, it corrupts. Plain and simple, it leads to a disregard for human life, for ethical considerations. People become willing to sacrifice anything, truth, justice, even lives for profit and control.
It's a pretty cynical view. But they do quote Scott Ritter, that former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer. He states it pretty bluntly, that quote about the United States doesn't help, it kills and destroys for its own benefit.
It's a strong statement, but they argue it's backed up by the evidence. Look at the history of Western intervention, the corporate exploitation, the way we've treated people in other parts of the world.
So they're saying that all this talk about spreading democracy, promoting human rights, it's often just a smokescreen, a way to justify actions that are really about self-interest, about maintaining power and control.
That's a key part of their argument. And they say this insatiable pursuit of power and wealth, it's ultimately self-destructive.
Creating these wastelands, both literally, like in Syria, and metaphorically here at home.
So given all of this, the big question becomes, what's next?
Yeah, where do we go from here? If all of this is true, if these forces are as powerful as they say, what hope is there for the future?
Well, that's what we'll explore in the next part of our deep dive. It's a tough question, isn't it? What hope is there? I mean, they paint a pretty bleak picture, but they do offer some, well, I'd call it a glimmer of hope. They say it's not too late, that we can resist this pull towards self-destruction, this wasteland idea.
Okay, but resist how? The scale of these problems, the hubris, the historical amnesia, power and greed, it feels, I don't know, almost impossible to change course.
Yeah, I get that. And they acknowledge there's no quick fix. This article isn't about giving you like five easy steps and everything's magically better.
Right.
But they do offer a way to think about these challenges, understand those root causes we talked about.
Right.
And then from there, maybe start to see what real change could look like.
So it's more about like a fundamental shift in how we see things, how we approach the problems rather than just specific solutions.
Exactly. They're calling for a change in consciousness, a reevaluation of our values, what we prioritize as a society.
It sounds pretty monumental. I mean, where do we even begin with something like that?
They argue it starts with awareness, facing the problem head on, not just seeing it, but acknowledging it, taking responsibility.
Okay.
Both as individuals and as a whole society for the choices we've made that led us here.
That's that moral reckoning thing we were talking about, right?
Yeah.
Admitting we've messed up, that we're part of the problem, not just pointing fingers elsewhere.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Recognizing our own complicity in the systems that create these wastelands, whether we like it or not. They say without that honesty, without that uncomfortable self-reflection, any change we try to make is going to be surface-level Band-Aid stuff.
Okay, but let's say we do that. We get real with ourselves, see our own shadows.
Yeah.
What's next? How do we go from awareness to actually doing something?
Well, they say the next step is reclaiming our agency. That word agency is key. We're not helpless in this.
Right.
We can choose to be part of the solution, not just sit back and be swept along.
Yeah, I think it's easy to fall into apathy or just feel totally overwhelmed. Like, what can one person do?
It's a natural reaction, but they're pushing back against that. We have more power than we think, both as individuals and when we work together.
Okay, so we've got the power, but what does that look like in practice? How do we actually use it to change things?
They give a few examples. One is becoming more conscious consumers, you know, thinking about where our money goes, what we buy, what companies we support. If we want a better world, are our choices reflecting that?
So, like, putting our money where our mouth is,
mm-hmm.
supporting businesses and organizations that align with our values.
Exactly. Then they talk about political engagement, not just voting every few years, but really staying involved, holding our leaders accountable, pushing for policies that put people and the planet first.
So voting, yeah, but also contacting our representatives, being active in local politics, supporting candidates who get it.
Yeah, who are actually working towards the kind of future we want. And then they also stress the importance of building community, finding like-minded people, those who share our values, and working together to create change from the ground up.
Kind of like finding your tribe and then actually doing something together, starting with our own communities.
Yeah, they're saying we don't need to wait for permission or for someone else to fix things. We can start right where we are with the people around us.
It's a powerful idea. That we can create change right now, even if it's on a small scale. But they also say we need to reconnect with nature. Remember that we're part of this web of life, not separate from it.
Yeah, that our well-being is totally tied to the health of the planet.
And we've kind of forgotten that, haven't we? We treat nature as this thing apart from us, a resource to exploit, not something we're intrinsically connected to.
They frame it as not just an environmental crisis, but a spiritual one. We've lost that sense of awe, of belonging, of recognizing our place in the natural world.
So it's about finding our way back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Reconnecting with nature, spending more time outdoors, maybe growing our own food, supporting policies that protect the environment. It's about realizing that taking care of the planet is ultimately taking care of ourselves.
Exactly. They're reminding us that even in the face of all this bleakness, all these potential wastelands, there's always the possibility of renewal, of growth, of creating something new and beautiful from the ashes of the old.
So even though they paint a pretty stark picture of the challenges, there's still a sense of hope running through it all. Like, it's not too late to turn things around to create a future that's more just, more in line with what truly matters.
It's a powerful message. They argue that the future isn't set in stone. We create it through the choices we make, individually and collectively, and through our willingness to imagine and fight for a different world.
It's about choosing to act, to resist, even when it feels overwhelming.
Exactly. They're saying we're not powerless. We have more agency than we think. And that's a message I think we all need to hear right now.
I agree. It's a call to action, a reminder that we can choose to be part of the solution. To create the kind of world we want to live in, not just for ourselves, but for future generations.
It's about stepping into our power, embracing our ability to make a difference, however big or small.
So we've been talking about this idea of Syria being like a warning sign, right? A mirror showing us what the West could become, these wastelands, not just physically, but morally, economically, all those levels. And you've said it's not too late to turn things around, to resist that pull towards self-destruction. But I gotta be honest, it all feels so huge, so ingrained. Where do we even start to make a difference?
It's a fair question. And the article, it doesn't pretend there's some easy answer. They're not giving us a 10-step program, like do these things and everything's fixed. But they do provide a way to think about it, to see the roots of the problem.
Okay.
And from there, we can start to imagine what real lasting change might actually look like.
So it's more about a shift in how we see things, not just specific actions to take.
Exactly. They say step one is, honestly, get past the denial. Confront those uncomfortable truths about our history, about how we're tangled up in the systems that created these wastelands in the first place.
So like that moral reckoning we talked about, right? Looking at our own actions, our choices, and how they've contributed to the problems, not just blaming other people.
Yeah, that's a core part of it. Owning up to our part as individuals, as Western society, in those systems of oppression, exploitation, all of it. They say if we skip that honest self-reflection, any changes we try to make are going to be shallow, temporary fixes.
Okay, but let's say we do that. We face the music, admit we're not perfect, maybe even that we've been part of the problem. Then what? How do we go from feeling bad to actually doing good?
That's where the agency comes in. And it's a big deal. They're saying we're not powerless, even if it feels that way sometimes.
Right.
We can choose to act differently, to be part of the solution, instead of just being carried along by the problem.
I think it's easy to feel helpless, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what can I do? It's too big.
Yeah, that's a human response. But they're urging us to push past that. We've got more power than we think, alone, and especially when we work together.
Okay, so we've got the power. But what's it actually look like? How do we use it to change things in the real world?
They give some ideas. One is becoming more aware of how we consume, where our money goes. Do the companies we support, the products we buy, do they match up with the world we want to live in?
So it's not just about what we say we believe in, but making sure our actions back that up.
Totally. And they also talk about getting politically involved, not just voting every few years, but staying engaged, holding those in power accountable, pushing for policies that actually prioritize people and the environment, not just profit.
So voting, yeah, but also like contacting our representatives.
Yeah.
Getting involved in local politics, finding candidates who get it and supporting them.
Exactly. Making our voices heard, showing up consistently. And then they talk about building community, too. Finding other people who share our values, who want a better world, and working together, starting at the local level.
It's like, find your people and get to work.
Yeah, and don't wait for someone to give you permission. Start making change right now, in your own community, in your own life, with those around you.
I like that, not waiting. But they also say we need to reconnect with nature, right? Like, remember, we're part of this planet, not just visitors.
It's crucial. They say the environmental crisis isn't just about science, it's spiritual too. We've forgotten our place in the web of life, that sense of awe and belonging.
So it's about healing that separation,
yeah.
Right? Getting back in touch with nature, whether it's spending time outdoors, growing our own food, or fighting for policies that protect the environment. It all ties together.
Absolutely. When we care for the planet, we're caring for ourselves in the long run.
I love that way of looking at it. So even with all the bleak stuff in the article, all these potential wastelands, there's this thread of hope running through it.
Yeah. It's not a happy-go-lucky, everything's going to be fine kind of hope, but more like a determined hope. They're saying it's not too late, but we have to act, make different choices, build a better future. And that future's not set in stone. We create it.
It's like instead of being passive, swept along by these destructive forces, we can choose to push back. To become the force for change that we want to see.
Powerful, right? Mm-hmm. They're saying we've got more agency, more ability to shape things than we often give ourselves credit for. And that's a message we all need right now.
I couldn't agree more. It's a call to action, a reminder that we're not helpless. We can choose to be part of the solution, to build a world that's more just, more sustainable, more in line with our values, not just for us, but for everyone who comes after us.
It's about stepping into our power, recognizing that we can make a difference. And that's a pretty inspiring thought to end on, I think.
Well said. Folks, that wraps up our deep dive for today. We've covered a lot of heavy stuff, but as we've seen, there's still reason for hope. The future isn't written yet.
It's up to all of us to decide what that future looks like.
So as you go about your day, keep this question in mind. If the West is heading towards its own wasteland, what's your responsibility? What does resisting that look like for you in your life, your choices, your actions?
And remember, even when things seem dark, we always have the power to choose a different path.
The power to create change is within each and every one of us. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time.